single crack would make the whole thing come down. Now she counted. A truck overturned on the other side of the highway. A highway memorial to someone who had died. A sign warning of a nearby maximum security prison. Ugly, ugly, ugly. Concrete sprawl and withered shrubbery baking in the heat. And Gemma, little Gemma, her small glowing secret, somewhere out there. There weren't enough pills in the whole world to shave Christina's fear into some manageable shape. A small white sphere she could swallow and let dissolve in her stomach. A sign blinked and disappeared behind them. 13 miles of highway left until they reached Nashville.
Part 2. Lyra, 10. Barely 6 hours after he let the skinny girl, Gemma Ives, and her cousin off at the Greyhound station, regretting on the one hand not keeping them for more questioning, and on the other hand himself exhausted, eager to believe that they were indeed heading to see someone who could help her, that they were not just two more junkies bussing toward their next high, the police commissioner in Nashville, Sarah Reese, called Detective Kevin Reinhardt's supervisor, Captain Basher, to say that Mr. and Mrs. Ives would be coming by the station. The day before, Gemma Ives' debit card had been used to purchase a one-way ticket to Nashville from the Knoxville Transit Center, and hours later she'd withdrawn $200 from an ATM at a rest stop in Crossville, suggesting she had indeed boarded a bus. It had been less than the requisite 48 hours since Mr. Ives' daughter had gone missing. Nonetheless, Reese was issuing an Amber Alert. The girl wasn't yet 18 years old. She was thought, perhaps, to be traveling with a boy. Detective Reinhardt knocked his chair over in his hurry. He didn't even double-check the girl's likeness. Her parents had sent the Crossville PD a series of photographic attachments, and Crossville had forwarded them on. Buses started running at 6 a.m., but she might still be there. He might have time to catch her. She needed sleep. There was still time. "Where are you going with your pants on fire?" Officer Cater was checking her teeth and her computer monitor, working a fingernail between her incisors. Christ, he should have been a dentist. He should have been a bus driver. He should have been something, anything else. He was already through the revolving doors, into air swollen and thick with the promise of more rain, and sprinting to the car, thinking there was still time to catch her. He plunged through the revolving doors at 6:17 a.m., exactly, record time, into the echo chamber of cell phone conversations and squeaky-soled sneakers, into a colorful foam of faces and rolling luggage. Any other person would have been overwhelmed, but Detective Reinhardt had been a cop for a long time, and his dad had been a cop, and his uncle was a cop, and so was his cousin Rebecca. So he looked not where all the color and sound was, but where it wasn't. The negative spaces, the empty corners and hallways and alcoves that regular people were trained to ignore. His eyes leapt over the crowd. He let himself drift. He released the station so that it floated away from him, like a boat unmoored from the shore. The girl, the funny, soft-spoken kid with the eyes made slightly bulbous from being too thin in the bright red backpack, was the only thing he could have clipped onto. Nothing. Nothing, nothing. "Now boarding, gate 3, 405 north to Boston." And then, a glimpse of red, a flash of platinum blonde hair, a girl who moved like she was drifting. Almost at once, the crowd reformed and he lost sight of her. It didn't matter. He was shoving his way through the funnel of people churning toward the gates, swirling around the big departures board. Someone stepped in front of him, and Reinhardt nearly went down over the wheels of a hideous green faux alligator suitcase. The man looked outraged, as if it were an actual alligator and Reinhardt had just trampled its tail. Only then did the loudspeaker voice touch his consciousness. "Now boarding, gate 3, 405 north, destination Boston, with stops in Washington, Philadelphia, and New York."
Gemma, 11. Where did it come from? On Monday, those words had pulled Gemma from one nightmare into another. Mirrors, she thought confusedly. Three-dimensional living mirrors. Three Gemmas wore identical expressions of bland curiosity. Three Gemmas had been split and fissured from a single central image. Unconsciously, she brought her hands to her face, her arms, her thighs, to make sure they were still intact, to make sure she was still intact. "Which number are you?" asked one of the mirrors. "You're not Cassiopeia," said another. The third one said, "Cassiopeia is dead." "I'm Calliope," said the first one. She added, "Number 7." In her eyes, Gemma was reduced to a narrow reflection, a reflection in a reflection in a reflection. Gemma thought of a double helix that mirrored even as it turned and turned. Symmetry, but a terrible kind. She sat up, half expecting the other Gemmas to move in response, but they didn't. "You think it's dumb?" one of the girls said. "Dumb how?" one of the others asked. "Dumb like number 8, the first one replied and turned. "Like Goose Down." Thud, thud, thud. Only then did Gemma see another one, a fourth one, even skinnier than all the rest, crouched in the corner not far from them. Her legs were bare and covered with scabs. She was wearing a diaper. She was so thin her head appeared gigantic, her features too far apart, as if they were wrapped around a fishbowl. Thud, thud, thud. As Gemma watched, she lifted her head and slammed it, once, twice, 3 times, against the wall. The sun caught a mesh of plaster, fine as dust, hanging in the air, sifting above her head, before slowly it began to fall. The sickest replicas were segregated from the rest of the population, concealed behind rudimentary curtains of burlap, kept mostly unconscious through regular dosages of morphine, at least according to what Gemma overheard. She might have been tempted to peek beyond the curtains and see for herself, were it not for the smell. Blood. Bodies in a constant state of hemorrhage, of organ failure, of beginning to turn. Someone was always getting sick, in the toilet, in a trash can, on the floor when they couldn't make it to a trash can. Gemma knew that prions weren't contagious, at least that they couldn't be spread by breathing. But still, she couldn't help but see prions turning invisibly on the air like sharp-pointed snowflakes, like dandelion fluff, like burrs that would stick in her lungs when she inhaled. Diapered toddlers who had never learned to walk instead crawled among the wreckage of dirt or simply sucked their fingers and cried. Nurses still wandered the halls like bewildered ghosts, as if questioning why on earth they couldn't just move on. They did the best they could to help, with limited supplies, dwindling medication, and power that failed regularly. A single building, L-shaped, and boys and girls separated by security at the joint. Soldiers moved through crowds of standing cadavers, hollow-cheeked and fire-eyed, dizzy with disease and starvation, by parting them with their rifles. When one of the soldiers, a girl with tight cornrows, stopped to comfort a bawling replica, another soldier reprimanded her.
"You'll give them the wrong idea," he said.
He was tall, with pale eyelashes and a burst of acne across his forehead.
"It'll only be worse in the end."
Gemma tried to find her way to Pete, to make sure he was okay, but was stopped by a redhead in full-on camouflage who looked like someone who might have been in her English class.
"Turn around," he said. "You speak English? Turn around!"
Another soldier, a girl with her nails painted different rainbow colors, was sitting in a single plastic chair still bolted down in a waiting area, otherwise empty of furniture. "They all speak English, dummy," she said softly. She was playing a video game on her phone. Gemma could tell from the sound effects.
"Doesn't seem like it, half the time."
Gemma had turned away from him, but not quickly enough to miss what he said next.
"Shit, I don't even like twins."
She wanted to scream, but just like in her dream, she couldn't. "Not me," she wanted to say. "You've got the wrong girl." But how could she? 3 other Gemmas tailed her. 3 Gemmas who stood shoulder to shoulder, blink, 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 breathing with her lungs, twitching with her hands, turning their heads on her own too short neck. no one would come to save her. Not a single person in the world knew where she was. Even when Pete's car was discovered, which she had no doubt it had been by now, there was nothing to suggest where they had gone. Not a trace of evidence, no ransom notes, no trail of blood. Her only hope was that somehow her parents would catch up to Lyra and Selim and realize what had happened. That her dad would charge in here in his big suit way, threatening to sue everyone from Saperstein to the President of the United States, and she and Pete would be saved. But she knew, too, that would mean that Lyra and Selim would have to take their place. Maybe the whole thing had a sick poeticism. After all these years, she'd finally ended up back where she started, where she belonged. It was better not to think. She gave up on trying to speak to anyone, and didn't bother trying to get anyone to speak to her. When Dr. Saperstein came back, he would see her, know her, and realize his mistake. That is, if her dad didn't find a way to track her down first. Until then, she simply had to survive.
Lyra, 11. Now boarding gate 3405 North, destination Boston, with stops in Washington, Philadelphia, and New York. Lyra came awake to a booming electronic voice. A cop was frowning down at her. "Can't sleep here," he said. He had to speak loudly above the echo of so many voices. Spokes of sun, a blur of people holding briefcases, women in sneakers that went squeak, squeak, and reminded her of the nurses, children shouting. She got to her feet, leaning hard against the wall for support. Selim was gone. Standing, she was even taller than the police officer. Sweat dampened her underarms, and she could smell herself. The cop squinted at her. "You all right?" "Fine," she said quickly. Her voice sounded like it had been chewed up. "Just waiting for my bus." He nodded as if he didn't quite believe it, but moved off anyway. She stood there breathing hard. Even the effort of standing had made her dizzy, and tried to think. She couldn't remember why she was there, only that Selim had been with her and now he was missing. The pattern of travelers was dizzying. Strangers threshed the lights into shadow patterns. A gigantic clock on the wall with tapered iron hands pointed to 6:09. She was going to be sick again. She closed her eyes and leaned her forehead against the wall, grateful for the coolness of the stone. Think. But she couldn't think. She couldn't remember a thing. Images came to her in flashes. Detective Reinhardt's big cow eyes throwing up in the toilet, the veins of blood. When she opened her eyes again, she thought for a moment, through the thick haze of sun, she even saw him moving through the shifting crowd of travelers. But then the pattern changed shape, and instead she spotted Selim, dodging the crowd without appearing to notice anyone else. "Here," he said when he reached her. He was holding a paper bag. From it, he produced a can of ginger ale, cold. "I thought you'd gone," she blurted out. She lowered her mouth to the soda can, sucking along its rim, comforted by the taste of metal. This was a haven taste, of tongue depressors and tubes behind the throat, even of thermoscan, though that had been made of plastic. He just shook his head. He looked happier than she'd seen him in a month. "I bought us tickets, too. The bus is boarding." She remembered now, dimly, those boys moving out of the dark, an impression of wet mouths and the harsh, bird-like cries of their laughter. She remembered kneeling in the gutter, trying to sort out her things from the collection of trash. "How?" she asked. He shrugged. "I told you I was going to get our money back," he said, "and I did. Some of it, anyway." She still didn't understand. She could hardly remember what they looked like. To her, they now seemed a blur, their faces eaten up by shadows and all their mouths identical and grinning. "You found those boys from last night?" she asked, but knew immediately from his face that wasn't what he meant. He took her free hand, pressing something into her palm. She opened her hand and found a battered leather wallet. She saw a flash of wadded bills before he took it back again. "They're all the same, Lyra," he said. "That's what you have to understand. Even the ones who say they'll help are the same." Her head was pulsing like the rubber pump of a stethoscope when it was squeezed. "You stole it?" she said. "They took from us," he said, "so I took back from them." It was wrong to steal. Lyra knew that. Once Calliope, one of Cassiopeia's genotypes, had stolen a cell phone from the nurse's break room. Even though they'd found it tucked inside Calliope's pillowcase, Nurse Swineherd had insisted that all of her genotypes be punished. Privately, Lyra believed that that was when Number 8 had gone so soft in the head, that maybe she'd been knocked too many times. Although the truth was that she had always been smaller than the others and much dumber, too, so maybe she'd simply been born that way. Selim was right. Why should they have to give so much and never take anything in return? If everyone believed they were monsters, shouldn't they at least be allowed to have teeth? She could feel Selim watching her, felt a question hanging between them like a very fine curtain of fabric. 6:20 now. Last call, gate 3, 405 North, destination Boston, with stops in Washington, Philadelphia, and on to New York. She looked up. The curtain parted. We better hurry, she said, if we want to catch the bus. They slipped easily through gaps in the kaleidoscope of people, like rats, like shadows. All the people Lyra passed did look the same. Their skin and hair and jaws began to blur into a smear of indistinguishable color, into people who were simply not like them. But then, for half a second, her eyes snagged again on a vision of Detective Reinhardt pushing frantically through the crowd. This time she was sure she hadn't imagined him. She nearly lifted a hand to wave, but then Selim took her hand in his, and together they sprinted the rest of the way to the bus, slipping inside just as the doors were closing.
Gemma. 12. There was nothing to do. No books, no magazines, no computers, no phones. Nothing but mattresses jigsawed on the floor, and hundreds of girls sticky with injuries sitting or lying around. Some of the replicas had made up their own games, rolling pen caps or stacking coffee cups. She even saw a girl, maybe 3 or 4 years old, playing with an old syringe. When Gemma tried to take it from her, the girl turned unexpectedly vicious, spitting in her face, going for Gemma's eyes. Gemma stumbled backward, and someone reached out to steady her. Again, Gemma had the sense of falling into a mirror. One of the reflections, one of her clones, had followed her. "Don't worry about the Browns," the girl said. Her eyes were always moving, around and around, taking in Gemma's hair and stud earrings and fingernails, which were painted yellow and green, alternating, as if trying to generate some centrifugal force that would pull Gemma closer. "They're all soft in the head." Gemma went from feeling angry to feeling sick. She turned around again and saw the girl had resumed her play, pulling up wool fibers from a patch of dirty carpet. Another girl, identical to the first, had scuttled closer to watch. Looking at them side by side made Gemma dizzy. "You're not one of us," the girl said. Her breath reeked, and Gemma felt sorry about being disgusted. "You were made somewhere else. There were only 5 genotypes at Haven, numbers 6 through 10, and number 6 is dead." "I know," Gemma said automatically. "I saw her." It made a twisted kind of sense that this girl could see what the people in charge couldn't or wouldn't. To them, the replicas weren't people. They were lab rats, or they were things, manufactured shells, like so many plastic parts cut from the same mold. It must be hard to keep track. The girl leaned closer, and Gemma had to stop herself from flinching. At the same time, she was seized by an impulse to dig her fingers into the girl's eyes, to pull them out, to tear off her skin. She wanted her face back. "Number 6 was named. We called her Cassiopeia. Dr. O'Donnell named me, too. My name is Calliope. Are you named?" Calliope's eyes were huge, hopeful. April called it Gemma's sad kitten face. Gemma nodded. "Gemma," she said. Calliope smiled. 2 of her teeth overlapped. She hadn't had braces, obviously, like Gemma had. "Gemma," she repeated. "Where were you made?" Gemma was exhausted again, though it couldn't be much past noon.
She wondered whether the girl had ever met anyone new, at least anyone who would talk to her. I was made at Haven, like you, but then I went somewhere else. Outside, Calliope said, exhaling the word as if it were the final piece of a powerful magic spell. After that, Calliope wouldn't leave Gemma alone. She followed Gemma when she walked the 282 paces she could walk, between the curtained-off wing where the sickest replicas lay mangled, tethered weakly to life by grim-faced nurses working a dozen machines, to the two bathrooms, men's and women's, in the no-man's land between the gendered sides. When Gemma sat, Calliope sat a few feet away, watching her. At one point, Gemma lay down and pretended to sleep. Still, she felt Calliope watching, and she sat up, finally, relieved to realize that she was angry, that there was another feeling elbowing in besides fear. What? Gemma said. Looking at Calliope still gave her a terrible sense of vertigo, like being spun around blindfolded and then discovering, with the blindfold off, that the world was still spinning. What do you want? She'd meant to scare her or startle her away, but Calliope kept staring. Gemma couldn't shake the feeling that Calliope had crawled into Gemma's body, that she wasn't another person but a shadow, a squatter. That would explain the tight, airless feeling Gemma had, as if when she breathed, it had to be for both of them. "I'm looking at you," she said, "to see what the outside looks like. You have hair like the nurses, and you're fatter," she added, but not meanly at all. Of course, Gemma realized, she didn't know that this was mean, like she didn't know it was rude to stare. This made Gemma feel sorry for hating her face, for hating to see her, for wishing she would disappear. Calliope tipped onto her knees and pulled herself closer, then rocked back on her heels again. She might have been Gemma's age, but she seemed younger. "Do you know Dr. O'Donnell?" she asked. "She's the one who named me. Then she left. A lot of them leave, but most of them not for good. She's outside, too," Calliope clarified, as if Gemma might not have understood. Gemma tried to swallow and couldn't. How to begin to explain? "I don't know Dr. O'Donnell," she said at last. "What about Pinocchio?" Calliope asked. "Do you know Pinocchio?" "Pinocchio?" Gemma thought Calliope must be joking, but she was completely serious. Her eyes were moon-bright, huge in that thin face, familiar and also totally foreign. It occurred to Gemma that she'd never heard Lyra make a joke. She'd never even heard her be sarcastic. "Pinocchio's made out of wood, just like a doll," Calliope said. She slid fluidly and without warning through different ideas, through fiction and reality, the past and present. "Wayne calls me Pinocchio, and I don't say how Dr. O'Donnell named me first. Names are like that. You have to be careful. Once someone names you, you belong to them for life." Pinocchio wanted to go to the outside and be a real boy. Once again, she leapt to a new stream of thought. She had no meaning, no system to unwind them, to decide what was important and what wasn't. "He got ate by a whale, but then he made a fire in the whale's stomach." She laughed, and Gemma flinched. It wasn't exactly a laugh, more like the sound of a hammer against metal. "He made a fire just like the one at Haven. He lit it right in the whale's belly, right here." She pointed to her own stomach. She seemed to find this hilarious. "Wayne told me how he did it, and so the whale had to spit him up. I seen fire at Haven, and I wasn't scared, not like some of them's." Untangling Calliope's speech took almost physical effort. She nearly explained that Pinocchio was only a story, but stopped herself. "Outside is huge," she said instead, "much bigger than you can imagine." Calliope hugged her knees, shrugging. "I know. I seen it through the fence, and on TV, too. Who cares, anyway? It dies. It dies. it dies. She turned and pointed casually to three replicas. It dies. She pointed to herself. Before Gemma could say anything, before she could deny it, Calliope was talking again. Haven is much bigger than where here is. Here is only the size of how A-Wing is at Haven. But there's more doors at Haven, and more nurses, too. I don't like the nurses, except for some of them are okay, because they feed us greens and blues for sleeping. One of the guards let me touch her gun. She spoke quickly, hardly pausing for air, as if the words were a kind of sickness she had one chance to get out. At Haven, we can't go in with the males because of their penises and how a normal baby gets made. So we have to stay away, except at Christmas for the choosing. Something touched Gemma's spine and neck, and made the fine blonde hair April had always called her goose down lift on her arms. Just like that, like bird feathers ruffled by a bad wind. "What do you mean, the choosing?" she asked. But Calliope wasn't listening. She was pinballing between stories and ideas, feeding Gemma all the words she had to carry alone. "Have you ever used a penis to make a baby?" she asked, and Gemma, stunned, couldn't answer. "The doctors still don't know if they can. I mean, if we can. The it's. Pepper got a baby in her stomach, but then she cut her wrists, so afterward they all got more careful." Gemma could hardly follow the story. Calliope combined pronouns, or used them indiscriminately. She'd heard Lyra and Selim refer to themselves as it at different times. All the replicas confused phrases like want and ask, make and own. "I owned it," one of the replicas insisted, when a nurse tried to take away a mold-fuzzed cup of old food remnants she'd been concealing beneath a panel of loose floor tile. "I owned it. It's me." And some of the replicas couldn't speak at all. They could only growl and keen like animals. "So the doctors don't know." Calliope was still talking, working a fingernail into a scab on her knee. When the blood flowed, she didn't even wipe it, just watched it make a small path down her shin, as if it was someone else's blood entirely. "Some of the its are too skinny for the monthly bleeding, but I have mine. Wayne said that means I'm a woman now." Nausea came like movement, like the rolling of a boat beneath her.
"Who's Wayne?"
"He's the one who told me about Pinocchio." Her eyes weren't like eyes at all. They were more like fingers grasping for something.
"I always wanted a baby," she said in a whisper. "Sometimes I used to go to postnatal and hold them and say nice things to them. Like I made them instead of the doctors."
Blood was rushing so hard in Gemma's head she could hardly hear. Infants. Babies. She hadn't seen any since she'd been here. What had happened to all of them? But she didn't have to ask. Calliope leaned forward, all big eyes, all hot little breath, all need. "Postnatal burned fast," she said. "The roof caved in, and all my babies got smashed." Gemma turned away from her, but there was nowhere to go.
"Nobody belongs here, child, not even the devil himself."
Calliope pulled away again, smiling to show her teeth. "I like Haven better for most things. But here's better because of the males, and how you can talk to them if you want." She said it so casually that Gemma nearly missed it.
Wait a second. She took a deep breath. "What do you mean, you can talk to them?"
Calliope smiled with only the very corners of her mouth, as if it was something rare she had to hoard.
"You can come with me," she said. "You can see for yourself."
Calliope came for her in the middle of the night. It could have been midnight or 4 a.m. There were no clocks in the holding center, and since arriving, Gemma had truly been aware of the rubbery nature of time, when there were no watches, phones, or activities to pin it down to.
"Follow me," she said, and took Gemma's wrist.
Gemma had seen staff members guide the replicas this way, and imagined this was where she'd learned it. They moved through the maze of sleeping replicas, most of them drugged up on sleeping aids distributed by the nurses before lights out. Pills for the replicas, whose pain was greatest, and, when those ran out, simply plastic mouthwash cups full of NyQuil. Gemma had thrown hers out, as she assumed Calliope must have too. As they passed through the darkness, Gemma again had a strange doubling feeling, as if she and Calliope were two shadows, two watermarks identically imprinted. Or maybe she was the shadow, and Calliope the real thing. Only one nurse, nodding to sleep in a swivel desk chair despite the lack of desk, jerked awake to ask where they were going. Calliope whispered, "Bathroom," and the nurse waved them on.
"Be quick," she said.
No man's land, the makeshift kitchen, the bathrooms, a plastic card table covered with scattered magazines and phone chargers, what passed for a break room for the staff during the day. A light in the kitchen was on, and as always, the coffee machine was burbling and letting off a burned rubber stink. There was always coffee brewing, at every hour, although so far Gemma hadn't actually seen anyone drink from the machine. Only a single soldier was on duty, the same red-haired guy with a pimply jawbone. He couldn't have been older than 19.
"That one never plays,"
Calliope whispered to Gemma.
"Plays what?"
Gemma whispered. But Calliope just shook her head.
"He thinks it's bad luck."
Gemma saw a quick look of pain tighten the soldier's features, as if seeing them together hurt. He turned away as soon as they veered right toward the bathrooms. At the last second, instead of going into the girls' bathroom, they simply went left into the boys'. Unbelievably simple. Gemma doubted the soldier had even noticed. He probably thought the replicas were all dumb anyway. It was reasonable to expect they'd make mistakes. The bathroom was only half lit. Most of the bulbs had burned out in the ceiling, and a sink filled with paper towels had overflowed, leaving puddles of water on the floor. The tiles seemed to pick up her voice and hurl it in a thousand directions. But the boys' bathroom had stalls at least, as well as two puddly urinals.
"What now?" Gemma asked.
"We wait," Calliope said.
"Come." She took Gemma's hand and pulled her into one of the toilet stalls. She closed the door behind them and sat down on the toilet seat. Less than a minute later, the bathroom door opened again. Calliope held up a hand, gesturing for Gemma to be quiet. For a long second, there was nothing but the drip, drip, drip of water from the faucet. Then a boy.
"Hello?"
Calliope stood up then. "In here," she said and opened the door. He was younger, maybe 12, 13. It was difficult to tell, since all the replicas, skinny as they were, with no concept of words they hadn't experienced directly, like snow and cross-country, seemed younger than their true age. But Calliope looked pleased anyway.
"A male,"
she said, as if Gemma might not be able to tell. The boy had very dark skin and perfect features, and the kind of lips Gemma's mom's friends paid money for. He would grow up to be beautiful. If he grew up.
"What crop are you?"
Calliope asked.
14, he said. "A white."
This made her smile.
"Like me,"
she said. "The whites are the most important." She turned back to Gemma again.
"Well, what do you want him for?"
"I need you to give someone a message for me," she said. He showed no signs of having understood.
"Another male.
Like me, from the outside. His name is Pete. Can you ask him to come? Can you bring him?" The boy looked at Calliope. She nodded, barely.
"What's for me?"
She tilted her head to look at him. Once again, Gemma had the uncanny, doubling sensation of watching herself in a funhouse mirror, the kind that elongated and thinned.
"Observation,"
she said, and held up one hand.
5 seconds.
He frowned.
"I want a stethoscope,"
he said. She shook her head.
"Observation."
He looked away.
10 seconds,
he said finally.
5 now, 5 when I bring him.
Finally, Calliope shrugged. Before Gemma could stop her, she lifted her shirt, exposing her chest, ribs visible, small pale nipples identical in shape to Gemma's, breasts stiff and small and hard, like little knots. Gemma was so horrified she froze, and by the time she thought to grab Calliope's arm to haul her shirt down, Calliope was already finished. 5 seconds, she said. She didn't seem bothered at all, and the boy didn't seem all that interested. Now go. He turned and left the bathroom. As soon as he was gone, Gemma said, You shouldn't have done that. She felt sick. They hadn't even cared that she was there, that she was watching. It hadn't occurred to them to care. She supposed observation for them happened in front of lots of people. She wondered if they even knew what privacy meant. You didn't have to. Calliope looked puzzled. It's only observation, she said. She smiled and showed her crowded teeth. I've observed with 12 males so far. Only number 44 is ahead of me. She's observed with 14. Plus, she lets anyone stethoscope with her, even the guards if they want. She spoke matter-of-factly. There was no playfulness to it. It wasn't pleasure, just something to do. It wasn't at all like the party games people had played in middle school, 7 minutes in heaven, the stoplight game, all of them excuses to squeeze a nipple in a dark room and knock braces for a bit. All night, Gemma imagined. The bathroom would fill and empty with replicas meeting to touch and bargain and barter and stare. Gemma leaned up against the counter, not even caring it was wet. The half-light made strange looping shadows on the walls and ceiling. Stethoscope? Like how the doctors and nurses do it, Calliope said. She placed a hand on her own chest to demonstrate, inhaling deep. Then she shifted her hand again, and again. Stethoscope. They'd invented their own term for second base. She dropped her hand. Have you ever done stethoscope? She asked. No, Gemma lied. She thought of being with Pete in her parents' basement, next to the rows of canned goods and bottled water, and how he'd traced the long scar between her chest and navel. It could have been a memory from someone else's life. She had the crazy idea that maybe Calliope and her other replicas would take not just her skin and hair and freckles, but her past, her life, her memory. The longer she stayed here, the less she would have that would belong to her and to her alone. She was losing it. She opened her eyes and fumbled to turn on the faucet, drinking from a cupped palm. Behind her, Calliope's face was a narrow shadow of hers. Then there's the full examining, Calliope was saying. Gemma didn't have to ask what that was. She could imagine well enough. But I've never done that yet. I tried one time with a green, but he got sick right in the middle. Then one of the guards came in and yelled. Gemma seized on this. Didn't you get in trouble? She asked. She didn't want to talk about examining and stethoscope and observation anymore. She didn't want to think about these broken kids playing doctor. Calliope looked puzzled. Lots of the guards play, too, she said. Gemma understood now what Calliope had said to her outside the bathroom and why the red-haired soldier had looked at them the way he did. He must know what went on at night, and what the other soldiers did with the replicas when they thought they could get away with it. The door opened again. The boy, the white, had returned, alone. Gemma's heart broke, actually broke. She felt it crumble in her chest like a nub of chalk. But before she could ask what had happened to Pete, the door opened a second time. And there he was. Pete. He looked as if he'd been shocked into aging 100 years. Feathery white eyelashes, hollows beneath his eyes, skin leached of color. And yet when he saw her, he smiled, and everything changed. Her whole world tilted and slid her toward him, into his arms.
"Fancy meeting you here," he said.
His voice was the same. He might have been teasing her during a long car ride, and she tasted salt before she realized she was crying.
"Hey," he said, pulling away to take her face in one hand. He wiped her tears with a thumb. "Hey now, it's all right.
Are you okay? She couldn't stop crying. Both Calliope and the male replica were watching them, truly curious, and Gemma could almost see Calliope calculating, trying to understand the way she and Pete were holding each other, what it meant, and what kind of examining this was. Did they hurt you?
I'm okay, Jem. I promise. I swear.
He ducked a little to look in her eyes, keeping one hand beneath her chin.
The food sucks, and this whole place could really use some body spray, but I'm fine.
It was unbelievable that he could make her laugh, but he did. And then she choked again, and he held her, and she heard his heartbeat through his chest and tasted her own breath on his T-shirt, and she lost track then of exactly who was who and where she ended and he began. It was like losing yourself in the softening of a warm bed you've been looking forward to all day. Then Gemma felt Calliope's fingers on her arm, cold fingers, needy. Only when Pete sucked in a breath did she realize how strange it must be for him to see both of them together. And when he took a quick step backward, something dark and heavy opened in the bottom of her stomach.
"We have to go now," Calliope said. "We had our turn."
But Gemma couldn't shake the feeling that Calliope had merely wanted to interrupt. She didn't like how Calliope looked at Pete, like someone starving who just wants to eat and eat and eat until she pukes.
"Christ!"
Pete exhaled and put a hand through his hair, tufting it like a bird's. They hadn't shaved it. That was one good thing, at least, that they were giving him that. He managed another smile.
"Sorry," he said to Gemma.
He reached out and took her hand, but his palm was sweating now.
"It's just..."
He shook his head. "I know," she said. "You don't have to say it." That cold, dark thing was still writhing at the bottom of her stomach, and Calliope breathed next to her, clinging to her like a film. She kept his hand in hers and pretended not to notice he was sweating.
"You'll meet me here again tomorrow night?"
"Every night," he said.
His eyes moved to Calliope and back again. Gemma pretended not to see that either. She took a step closer to him. "They're not going to let us out, Pete," she said in a low voice, though there was no point in trying to keep it a secret. Calliope could hear everything. Maybe she could even hear inside of Gemma's head. "We know too much."
"We'll find a way," he said,
and his eyes softened. Then Calliope took Gemma's hand, and Gemma wondered whether she had just learned that kind of touch from watching Pete. How many of the other things she did and said were just imitation? Simulacrum. A slight, unreal, or superficial likeness. Calliope's fingers were long and very bony.
"We had our turn," she repeated. "More of them get to go."
"I didn't get my second observation," the boy said.
Calliope turned back to him.
"Next time you'll have stethoscope, then," she said,
as if it hardly concerned her. "Tomorrow," Gemma said to Pete, even as Calliope drew her toward the door.
"I promise."
But he was looking at Calliope, not at her, and she felt a sudden dread. Now it was Pete doubling, splitting in two, and becoming a twin version of himself who looked the same, who talked the same, but was, deep down, a stranger.
Lyra, 12. Lyra and Selim arrived in Philadelphia just after 11 p.m., and still a crush of people poured with them into the station. Every time she thought she must have seen all the people there were in the world, all the buildings and cars, they kept coming. It was a little like watching distant waves in the Gulf of Mexico, as she had sometimes done at Haven, to see the way each wave in fact hauled dozens, hundreds, thousands more on its back. Lyra knew that Dr. Saperstein was going to speak on Tuesday at a place called UPenn. That was what the people who had taken Rick Harless away had said. She had been keeping careful track of the days, as Rick had taught her to, and knew that they were a day early. Still, she was nervous. Remembering how helpful Detective Reinhardt had been, Lyra suggested that they ask a police officer for directions. Selim was less certain. The day before, he'd been shunted between holding cells and desks and grim-looking officers for hours, waiting to be booked. But after 2 hours of wandering, he finally agreed. They circled back to the bus station where there were plenty of cops. But the first one just shook his head. "If you're here for the protests," he said, "you'd be better off just turning right around. This country's got bigger things to worry about, and we've had guys down there clearing the roads for 2 days. Besides," he added, narrowing his eyes, "it's almost midnight. Don't you have somewhere to be?" The second one, a woman with her hair in tight braids like Dr. Fine Yes had worn back at Haven, just stared at Lyra for a long time, up and down, as if her eyes were a broom and Lyra a bunch of dust. "How old are you, honey?" she asked, and Lyra grabbed Selim's hand and hurried away without answering. By then, Lyra was too tired to continue. Exhaustion kept rolling up and crashing over her, hauling her down into brief, blinking moments of darkness, so she would come alert and realize she didn't remember crossing a park or she didn't know how they'd ended up inside a neon-bright restaurant that sold hamburgers flattened like palms. They found a Motel 6. They had no ID since Lyra's wallet had been stolen, but the desk clerk just shrugged and handed over a key anyway. "No smoking in the rooms," he called out after them. "I'm serious." In the room was a carpet the color of vomit, an ancient wallpaper that still exhaled the smell of old cigarettes and booze, two twin beds and an old blocky TV, a bathroom where mold inched between tiles and decals on the tub floor peeled like brittle leaves. It was the prettiest room Lyra had ever seen, except for the one in the little white house where they'd first been taken by Gemma. She couldn't believe how big it was, how spacious, that it was all theirs for the night. How many rooms, she thought, must there be in the world? How many rooms like this one, folded across the vast space of the world, pretty and quiet and safe, with doors that locked? It was a beautiful idea. She showered first, taking her time, letting herself imagine that her body didn't belong to her at all, that it was just an object, a broken-down chair or a table full of surface cracks, and that she herself was somewhere different, that she would not be affected if her body gave out entirely or was discarded. Afterwards, she stood in the cloudy bathroom, listening to the muffled noise of the TV from the bedroom, feeling suddenly nervous. She had been with Selim countless times in vacant trailers and behind the supply shed and played a game of kissing each other's scars and the thin, fragile skin on the inside of the elbows and the back of the knees. But that was in the dark, at Winston Abel, in a room musty with spiderwebs and the smell of bike tires. That was washing up accidentally somewhere and clinging to each other because there was nowhere else to go. This was different. She knotted a towel around her chest. Before Selim could even turn to look at her, she'd slipped into the bed closest to the bathroom, shivering when the cold sheets touched her bare skin. She pulled the covers to her chin. "Are you finished?" he asked, and she saw his eyes move down to her shape beneath the blanket, and this made her shiver too. The drumming of the shower in the bathroom, the murmur of TV voices, soon she was asleep, falling off the edge of sound into quiet. She woke to movement, the rustle of sheets and the sudden touch of cold air. She'd fallen asleep in her towel, and she was cold. The lights were off, and the TV was off, and it was quiet except for the faint hum of an air conditioner. For one disoriented second, she didn't know where Selim was. She had a vague sense of his outline standing beside her, watching her sleep. "What are you?" she started to say, but then Selim was sliding in next to her in bed, naturally, as if there was no other place to be. He looped a heavy arm across her waist. He wasn't wearing a shirt, only a thin pair of boxer shorts. She could feel his chest rising and falling, his breath on her cheek, his ankle bones when he moved, and immediately she wasn't cold anymore. She was burning hot. "Lyra," he whispered. But before she could say what, he put his mouth against her neck. Then she realized that it hadn't been a question after all. He found a gap in the towel and slid his hand to her stomach. He touched the architecture of her hips. He moved a hand carefully, gently between her thighs. "Lyra, Lyra, Lyra," he said again, sing-songing it as if he were learning how to speak through saying her name. She wasn't a human. She wasn't a replica. She was a star trail, burning through the darkness, lighting up the room in invisible spectrums of color. "Selim," she said, turning over to him and opening her mouth to his, letting him pour this new language inside of her, letting it transform them together into music.
Gemma. 13. She woke to the deep, navy light of a pre-dawn sky. Already the holding center was full of voices and movement, the scuffle of rubber sneakers, the tooth chatter of heavy equipment scraped along the ground. She sat up, edging away from Calliope, who had insisted on sharing the twin mattress. When she stood, she was dizzied by a sharp, sudden hunger. She'd received a minuscule ration of spongy baked pasta for dinner, spooned from a tinfoil-covered catering tray of the kind Gemma associated with school fundraisers. Gemma knew that meant there must be civilization nearby. A restaurant, a deli, something. She'd even found a receipt for a Joe's Donuts in Windsor Falls, Pennsylvania, coasting on a surf of overflowing trash outside the bathroom. But Pennsylvania or Pakistan? What did it matter? No one knew where they were. The sleeping replicas, motionless in the half-dark, were so closely fitted together that they took on the quality of a single landscape, mounds of soft earth, rigid spines and shoulders. A sudden light dazzled her, and she turned to the window to see a van wheeling away, its headlights briefly revealing funnels of rain. More vans were arriving. She saw soldiers jogging with rain slickers pulled down to protect their faces. Someone was using orange light sticks, like a real airport ramp handler, to indicate where the van should park. And out of the airport came a constant flow of equipment. Staff members passed in and out, hauling plastic bins and waste containers, paperwork lashed into waterproof boxes, medical equipment, stacks of unused linens, snowy piles of plastic-wrapped Hanes t-shirts, hundreds of them, of the kind that were given to the replicas. Gemma felt as if the rain had found its way inside. She was suddenly very awake and very cold. They were closing up shop. She picked her way between the replicas to the central corridor, full of a deep and driving panic, half expecting to find that she was alone, that the walls had been dismantled and the rug pulled up, that she had been left behind. Several nurses, bleary-eyed from lack of sleep, pushed past her wheeling IV carts. The atmosphere was tense, almost desperate. "What's happening?" Gemma asked, without expecting anyone to answer, and no one did. "What's going on?" A patrolling soldier frowned briefly at Gemma before turning her attention back to several staff members trying to work a medical cart through a door down to the loading dock. "Careful," she said. "Stairs are wet." Gemma noticed her fingernails were painted pink. She kept walking, feeling as if she were in the beginning of a nightmare. Even before anything bad has happened, you know, you're sure, that bad things will come. When guards in no man's land prevented her from going any farther, she went again to the window, mesmerized by the look of all the headlights through the rapidly ebbing dark. How quickly would it take them to clean the place out, to erase all the evidence that Haven had ever existed? And what would they do with the replicas? Why the sudden urgency? Why now? But the last question, at least, was answered even as she stood at the window, squinting through a mist of condensation. Because a new vehicle was arriving, not a van, but a regular sedan, like the kind of shitty rental a budget travel agency might give you. From the driver's seat came a tall man with a dark beard and glasses. He stood for a second, squinting up at the airport, his glasses and the glow of the exterior lamps, so bright it looked like they themselves were glowing. He grimaced a little as the rain hit him, then he ducked and began to jog through a slosh of puddles toward the door, and Gemma saw a flurry of movement, flapping raincoats and umbrellas, as he was enfolded by staff members and hustled inside. Dr. Saperstein was back. A woman in a tailored pantsuit came for Gemma mid-afternoon. It was the same woman Gemma had pegged for a government slug when she had first arrived. As far as Gemma could tell, it was the same suit, too. They went through a door marked with a sign that unnecessarily stated, "Authorized personnel only," guarded by two soldiers with long-range rifles. Down a set of stairs, the same ones they'd climbed Sunday night. Gemma knew they must be level with the tarmac, imagined phantom travelers hurrying with rolling suitcases and duffels toward waiting short-haul jets. Through another door for authorized personnel, they reached what must once have been the airport's administrative hub, an inner funnel of connected rooms still showing the ghost marks of old desks. The overhead lights were out, and a few standing lamps left whole areas oily with shadow. There were tubs of plastic containers full of shrink-wrapped sterilized needles and miniature urine collection vials. Two fridges were marked with handwritten signs, "Live specimens do not open." Hidden generators bled thick cables across the floor, and Gemma thought of bits of dark hair clinging to the damp floor of a gym. Stacked messily on a folding table were cardboard boxes full of translucent medical gloves and antibacterial cloths, cotton swabs, and rubber thermometer tips, laptops wired to a single power strip, and three-ring binders. Here, she knew, must be the remains of Haven's record-keeping, the experiential evidence it had accumulated over decades, and had not yet had a chance to move elsewhere or destroy. Another woman, this one a stranger, leaned knuckles down on a desk, in the posture of a gorilla peering over the shoulder of a red-haired guy at a computer. She immediately straightened up. "Aw, shit." The woman had to step over the fluid ropes of electrical cable to get close. Her hair was cut short. She reminded Gemma of one of her favorite nannies, Laverne, a soft-spoken Haitian woman who'd come up from Louisiana and gave hugs that felt like being wrapped in a blanket. But the impression was over the moment she spoke.
"What a mess."
"Hi yourself," said Gemma's escort.
"Not what you thought?"
The red-haired guy was still lit faintly by the computer screen, and the glare in his glasses had the weird effect of erasing his eyes beneath them. There was something wrong with the skin on the left side of his face, and his chin beneath his lips. It looked weirdly shiny, as if it were covered with a layer of Vaseline. He'd been badly burned, Gemma realized, and her stomach yanked. He'd been at Haven. Laverne, not Laverne, took two sudden steps forward and snatched up Gemma's chin, as if it were a fish that might otherwise dart away. She angled her face left and right before Gemma managed to pull away.
"I don't know where she came from."
Her eyes on Gemma's face felt like mosquitoes, circling and circling without landing anywhere.
"She's not one of ours."
"I told you," Gemma said, though it was obvious the woman wasn't speaking to her. She let her hatred narrow like a knife inside her. "You guys fucked up, big time." Not Laverne was still staring.
"Werner, pull up sources, will you?"
She pivoted finally and moved behind the computer again, leaning over to point.
D-101, she said. "See here? Some of our first donor tissue. And these are the genotypes that took. Number 6 through 10.
"Number 6 is disposed," the man, Werner, said.
The woman in the suit was sweating.
"You told us a boy and a girl. This one and her boyfriend fit the description."
"They aren't ours."
Not Laverne looked green. Werner was chewing on an unlit cigarette. Then,
"Dr. Saperstein will nail you to the wall for this."
Gemma was sick of being spoken about as if she wasn't in the room. "My name is Gemma Ives. Ives," she repeated, and saw Not Laverne register the name, saw it pass through her like a current.
"Ives?"
Werner nearly choked. He wet his lower lip with his tongue.
"Is that like..."
But he trailed off nervously as behind Gemma another door opened and then closed firmly with a click. The sudden silence filled the room by emptying it of pressure. She felt a pop in her ears as if they'd just dropped altitude on a plane. She turned, knowing already what she would see.
Dr. Saperstein, smiling, holding his glasses in one hand, shaking his head, like some kindly guidance counselor who discovered a mistake in her first period schedule.
The last time I saw you, you were 6 months